This is CliffCentral.com.
Love that song, Alicia Keys, and Try Sleeping with the Broken Heart. Just after 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. It is Thursday. It's time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. And as part of the Burning Platform this morning, before we even get to Canthan Pillay and our analysis of some of the big stories of the week, let's check in with Anthea Gardner, who is on Skype to tell us all about the budget speech. Good morning, Anthea. How are you?
Good morning, Gareth. I'm very well, thanks.
You know, I have the option of not watching the budget speech, but you, of course, have to watch it because it impacts so in such diverse and important ways on everybody, from the ordinary consumer and the way that they behave in terms of buying things and selling things and what happens to their policies and their pensions and whether people are paying more or less tax. And then it goes all the way up to massive fund managers and people like you who have to manage other people's money. And you have to decide where to put that money based on what Tito Mboweni, in this case, has decided to do in the new financial year. So, what happened?
All right. And I'm going to cover all of that, and especially what I'm going to do with investments. So, I mean, I think the governor, sorry, not the governor. I keep calling him the governor. I'm still used to him being...
Yeah, governor of the Reserve Bank.
It was his job once.
Yes.
Okay. So Tito said very succinctly, we earn 1.58 trillion rand. We spend 1.83 trillion rand, which leaves us with a shortfall of 243 billion rand.
Just go through that again. You said we earn more than we spend. It's the other way around.
No, we earn 1.58 trillion rand.
Yes.
We spend 1.83 trillion rand.
Yes, that's right. That's not what you said just now. That's why I was
confused.
Oh,
my apologies.
Okay.
You know what I'm like with numbers.
Well, that worries me. Okay. So basically, we've got a shortfall. We're living beyond our means.
243 billion rand beyond our means, which, of course, is going to go to borrowing. So we now have to keep borrowing. And in fact, he said it, if you exclude weekends, we're borrowing 1.2 billion rand a day.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's just scary and crazy. And actually, of that 243 billion rand deficit, 209 billion rand is interest payments on the debt that we're borrowing. So we're in what's just like a crazy debt spiral at the moment. It's very scary. I mean, you know the scene, right? I don't have to set the scene for you. We've got low GDP growth, which they downgraded from previous expectation of 1.9 this year to 1.5. We've got Eskom, SOEs just falling apart. It's a scary state of affairs, Gareth. It really is. Okay, so let me go through kind of one by one. Actually, before I get off the borrowing thing, I must just say the National Treasury is very funny because obviously previously they've set themselves a borrowing or a debt ceiling. Mm. So now they need to borrow more money. And what do? They just up the debt ceiling.
So how come this is such a bad thing? Because America has enormous debt as well. Don't they have an even bigger deficit than we have by an order of magnitude?
Absolutely. And America can borrow from other countries in the world at an interest rate of below 2%. We're currently borrowing at 9%. And America has much higher GDP per capita than we do. So they generate more money and are able to service that debt, and that debt service level is not as high as a percentage of GDP.
This is like me living in my modest house with a modest car, looking at my neighbor who's living in a mansion with a Ferrari and being jealous that my neighbor got a home loan.
That's right. And that your neighbor makes a lot more money
than you do.
Earns a higher salary than you do. Yes, okay. That's exactly right.
I saw Chris Hart, the economist, saying the three ugly sisters, rampant corruption, overtaxation, overregulation. These are self-inflicted own goals. We need to see a climb down from these mistakes. As a country, relative competitiveness was not improved. No fundamental change in the thinking. Don't expect a change in outcomes. So Tito gave the adult in the room speech, according to Justice Malala, who's been a regular contributor to the Burning Platform. Do you think his speech was different to former speeches given by former finance ministers?
I think he did the best he could do. Honestly, I think he's very charming. He didn't shy away from the issues. There was like a little cheer in the room here when he mentioned that the public sector wage bill was going to be decreased. As from what he's got, he did just fine, to be honest. I don't think he could have done any better. It is election year, so he couldn't increase VAT or... And quite frankly, do we want him to increase VAT? No, because the consumer's under so much pressure as it is. He did say, like, a couple of things that I really liked he said was that they'll give Eskom a bailout. So, you know, 23 billion rand per year for 3 years. Eskom gets a nice little bailout. But there are conditions. One condition, the government will not take Eskom's debt onto their balance sheet. What a relief. That's a big thing. And then secondly, they'll put in this CRO, you know, this officer of strategy, if you like. I mean, sure, it makes little sense to appoint another very expensive person to the board of Eskom or to run Eskom or to oversee Eskom, I should say. Mm-hmm. But at least it's going to be governed by Tito Mboweni himself and Pravin Gordhan. Mm-hmm. So they will oversee Eskom and see how this money's spent and try and get it back on track. So in 3 years' time, if Eskom's not back on track, well, then we'll just blame our finance minister. The other thing about Eskom is that they're wanting to break it up. But what he didn't say was he didn't talk about the sale of assets. So he said, we're going to break it up and we're looking for a private equity investor, which means that they'll get some money in. So the government will maybe recuperate some of that money that they're lending to Eskom. But at least, you know, there's a plan, basically, which I like.
All right. Are there any increases in tax?
So no, actually. I mean, the usual nonsense, sin taxes, right? Yeah. So you've got... what was it? A 7.4% increase in alcohol and a 9% increase in tobacco. No VAT increase. And what was interesting about this, Gareth, is that they didn't put up VAT or your
personal income tax.
Personal income tax, that's right. But there will be bracket creep. And what that means is that the rebate was so small that as you get a salary increase, you fall into a higher bracket. And even though it's an election year, and what you want to do is keep them, the politicians want to do, is keep their voters happy, I think the voters have been misled almost. And I can explain this by example. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
If you're earning 2 million rand taxable income, your net tax liability after this rebate rises 7%, and if you get a 6% pay hike, so kind of inflationary. If you're earning 500,000 rand, that same inflationary salary increase, so by 6% increase, your net tax liability rises 9.4%. So the person who's going to suffer the most actually are the middle class, the middle income earners. The upper class don't suffer, which is very interesting because normally you kind of do something in an election year to keep the majority of the population happy. And by not raising VAT, you think you're keeping the voters happy. And by not putting up income tax, you think you're keeping the voters happy. But actually, in this budget, the middle class are going to suffer a lot more.
That's absolutely spot on.
Yeah, Canton's joining in here, Anthea, because I think he
yeah, the budget creep is a really sneaky way of just making sure that they're still able to get money out by pretending that they haven't raised taxes. But Anthea, you haven't mentioned the carbon tax, though.
Oh, yes. So there's that, and then there's the sugar tax, and there's a whole kind of lot
stealth
of what I call soft taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. What is this carbon tax, Canton?
It's about 1.3 billion rand that essentially the whole idea is that for the longest time now, there's been this theory that we are responsible for global warming. So, you know, it's the whole anthropogenic theory of global warming. Look, global warming is real, mm-hmm. but whether carbon dioxide causes it is something
still up
that's
up for debate.
That's up for debate. But that doesn't
You're a climate change denier.
No, I firmly believe in climate change. I just don't believe it's carbon dioxide that's responsible. But the crucial thing is that many parts of the world actually implement a tax on carbon as a way of actually benefiting from climate change is big business.
Yes,
we've had the carbon tax legislation tabled about 3 years ago, but it was not implemented up until now because of the consequences for the economy. Because there are huge consequences. If you think, for example, that you know, every single bit of transport, every bit of manufacturing, you now have to calculate what am I.
So where do they tack that on when you fill up with petrol?
No, well, petrol they've
already got a tax
petrol,
on that.
Petrol already has a separate levy on it. But I don't know. Let's say if you're a farmer and your cows are producing
farts.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Is that what they
anyway, 1.3 billion is coming in from the implementation of the carbon tax, and it'll be interesting to see how that actually sneaks in, because that is one where once they've got it in, that's the boiling the frog thing. They'll start, you know, steadily ramping that up.
Yeah, Anthea, let's just go back to the rands and cents here for a second. You said it. There's not a lot Tito can do. He hasn't got a huge amount of space to play in, right?
That's right. I mean, he really is hamstrung. The really great news, of course, is that he's hoping to get 27 billion rand by cutting the public sector wage bill. And that was a big one. You know, so he said there will be no increases for public servants. Oh, sorry, no. So no increases for MPs and legislators.
Yeah.
And but public servants the, okay, will so be
on,
offered.
On that note, the government wage bill at the moment is 34% of national expenditure. But the president's salary will increase. And now,
that's right.
He doesn't need it. Donald Trump isn't taking
point.
A salary. Donald Trump, that evil, evil orange man in America who everybody loves to hate, he isn't taking a salary because he's a billionaire already. And so is Cyril.
Yeah, that's very disappointing, actually, that Cyril is going to take an increase. And you're right, like, he doesn't need it.
I strongly suspect, guys, that there's a bit of electioneering here. I think that Cyril's going to turn around and say, even though I have been given a pay increase by the finance minister, I'm very pleased to announce that I'll be donating that increase to the charities that I've been donating to in the past.
Okay.
So it's electioneering.
So don't take it too seriously.
So don't take it seriously. Okay.
All right, so
can't
Anthea,
trust them at all.
They would be really good, though, if we cut the public wage bill. Do you think it's possible?
I absolutely think it's possible. There are far, far too many older people sitting in, especially these SOEs, and just collecting wages when they're not making that much difference. You know, Eskom particularly, if you compare it to the rest of the world, already has far too many people working in it. And I can't remember what the number was, but it was an extraordinary number of bodies that on seats that you just didn't need, and especially not to make. The concern, of course, is that you lose a little bit of institutional memory. Younger staff don't have the experience. They get paid less for it. But at least we can save some money there. So, that's a great thing. Now, can I wrap up by giving you a bit of a shock? I think this budget is not going to be enough to stop Moody's from downgrading us.
I agree completely.
So at the moment, we're on stable watch with Moody's. And for them to downgrade us to junk status, they basically have to skip a stage, which is putting us on negative watch and then downgrading us to junk. But I don't think they're going to do that. I think that they're going to downgrade us and put us down to negative watch now and then downgrade us to junk status in October with the medium-term budget speech.
Oh, so then that's not great, because then we really do end up with a debt problem that is insurmountable.
But you know, Gareth, this is something that I'm almost feeling it's priced into the market already. So our bond yields are kind of already trading at junk status. Can we just get this out the way? There'll be a big sell-off in our bonds because we fall out of the WGB, the World Government Bond Index.
Mm-hmm.
Our yields will probably spike to 10.5%, 11%. So it'll be the rand will blow out. It'll be like a freight train. It'll hit us. It'll be ugly. But then things will go back to normal. You know, the rand will probably pull in. You know how markets are. They always overreact. The rand will probably pull in again. Bond yields will pull in. And if you have dry powder, that's the time to be buying bonds, you know, when yields are hitting 11%. Because I think, so this falling out of the WGB is a technical issue because global investors are benchmarked by this index. they have to hold or don't have to hold according to whether we're investment or junk status.
Anthea, just a quick question. Have you been tracking what the flows have been like on the bond market? I did check the day after the Sona, and there was a net sell-off of 2 billion rand on the day after the State of the Nation address, but I haven't been keeping track since, so I don't know how it's performing.
Generally speaking, in the last 6 months, we've actually seen huge inflows into the South African market, and the outflows have been absolutely negligible. You know, like one day of negative outflows doesn't make up for 6 months of generous inflows.
Absolutely, but I'm concerned about the time between the Sona and currently.
Oh no! So I haven't. I don't know what the net number is.
Got it. Okay.
Between the two dates, exactly. What is it? Two
no
weeks
pressure.
Now.
All right. So Anthea, thanks for a bit of an oversight there of what went on in the budget. We'll talk in some detail going forward. From Canton's got a whole spreadsheet in front of him of what else is in the budget. But thank you for your insights, and we will check in with you on Monday.
Fantastic.
Very good. Anthea Gardner, Money Shot on Monday. Don't miss that. Back to the budget speech. Here are the very basic numbers. So 209.2 billion for economic development, 386.4 for learning and culture. Don't know what that means. Is that education?
I believe so.
Okay, learning and culture. Peace and security, 211.0.
Probably policing, maybe.
Yeah, 222.6 billion for health, 65.3 for general public services, 208.5 for community development, 202.2 for debt service costs, and 278.4 billion for social development. So social development, separate category to economic development. More spent on social development than economic.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, no pay hike for members of parliament, as we discussed, and no tax increases, at least in the obvious spheres.
Yes, but, you know, as we've discussed, in fact, for people who end up with inflation-related increases, most of that increase gets taken away from them in the form of taxation. So, yes, the finance minister has been sneaky and... ultimately, Anthea is absolutely right. The people who are going to end up paying the most are going to be middle-class people who end up with pay increases that push them into the next tax bracket.
So the harder you work, the more you get punished.
Absolutely.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's just talk quickly about tax for one last second, because I saw that the GDP burden... the tax to GDP burden has been released by the World Bank. So in other words, what is the tax rate that people pay in comparison with the GDP of that country? And right at the top is Lesotho, which is a 40.52% proportionality between tax and GDP. So you pay very high taxes for a very low GDP in Lesotho. Denmark is at number two. Very high tax rate there because it's a social democracy in the proper Scandinavian form. Namibia is at number three. The Seychelles at number four. Solomon Islands number five. Macau at number six. Swaziland at number seven. New Zealand at number eight. And South Africa at number nine. So that's us at number nine. And we also pay most of the tax for numbers one, three, and seven.
Absolutely
right. Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland.
Yes, via SADC, yes.
Correct. So there we go. How do you like them apples?
Well, if you go further down that list, you'll notice that our neighbor to the north, Botswana, actually...
Number 20.
Yes. Yeah. So Botswana is substantially better off than we are in terms of managing that.
All right. So that's tax. I mean, you want to talk some more about the budget?
No, not particularly. I think, you know, there were a couple of interesting things that emerged. The one is that if you do the calculation in terms of the interest that we're paying out... So, you know, it's 209 billion in interest payments in our current budget, plus the stuff that one ends up paying out for Eskom and and the like. So effectively, we as a nation are paying out something like a billion rand a day in interest. So just, you know, let those numbers digest. A billion rand a day is flowing out in interest. And of course, at the time of Mbeki's presidency, that debt was not there. And so that money was then being able to be channeled into things like social grants, which, you know, immediately fed the bottom line So, yes, we are paying the price for Zuma's misdemeanors.
Yeah, let it never be said that government doesn't affect you, even if you don't vote, even if you don't. All
but,
these things
but
that
basically
we're talking
about. What it comes back to is that if really what we should be doing, the quick way to fix this issue, if you consider 34% of government expenditure goes to the public service wage bill, really what we need to do is to vote this government out of power and shut down the public service. And guess what? Our problems go away overnight.
Really?
So it really is that simple. Just think about it. 34% of expenditure goes to public servants that for most of us don't provide any public service. Mm. So vote the ANC out of power, shut down the public service, or substantially reduce it. You know, lop off that, take that 34%, push it down to 20%, say.
Mm. And make a huge difference.
And you've made enough money to actually solve our country's problems. So the problem right now is not the economy. The problem is the African National Congress government.
Hard words. Someone else is having problems with funding at the moment. See, Julius's sugar daddy, Adriano Mazzotti, has been implicated in a SARS move. They have decided to seize his assets and have begun their efforts to reclaim the near 34 million rand that he owes to the tax firm.
Yes, well, again, you're
does this impress you?
Putatively owes the taxman. I was fascinated by seeing the list of stuff that's being confiscated. Why does anyone need so many cars? I just don't get this.
Yeah, it's been reported Mazzotti's collection of luxury BMW and Mercedes vehicles are being towed away to settle the debt. One of the companies the businessman owns, Real Time Investments, are believed to have an unpaid tax bill of 71 million rand in addition to the 34 that they're going after. He's the co-director of Carnilynx, which is a cigarette manufacturing company that is allegedly involved in the illicit tobacco trade. And it goes back to 2013, his relationship with Julius, where he donated 200,000 to the EFF. It's amazing. You don't even have to give him that much.
Well, I think the 200,000 rand was the deposit to allow them to contest the elections.
Wow.
So, one could argue that he's responsible for creating the EFF.
Sure. So, white monopoly capital, huh?
Yes. But if we can just talk for a second about, you know, because this actually ties in with the cigarette taxes.
Yeah.
The absurdity of cigarette tax increases when we have a really serious problem in terms of illicit cigarette deals. If you think of the logic around this, I forget the – Sia, do you remember the numbers in terms of what is the tax on a packet of cigarettes? I think it's something like 17 rand or something like that is the amount of money.
What does the packet of cigarettes even cost these days? I don't smoke, so I don't know these things.
Me either. But
if somebody knows, give us a call.
I think the last figure I heard was somewhere around 50 rand for a pack or something like that. But off which, you know, something like 17 rand goes directly to the taxman if you buy it legally. Now, if you in the business of making cigarettes, now just think about this. It actually makes sense for you to flood the market with illicit cigarettes because then you can sell it at your price plus a markup of about 2 rand illegally, as opposed to sending it to the sponsor shops who then need to end up paying 17 rand.
So are you saying perversely in some way all of these sin taxes have created a space for illicit tobacco trade?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
the government's also responsible for the Adriano Mazzotti's.
Yes, well, I saw one figure yesterday that said something like the tax on a single bottle of whiskey is something like 65 rand. So if you consider that you buy a cheap bottle of whiskey, I don't know.
150, 170 rand.
You know, I think VAT 69 goes for something like 130 bucks or something like that. It's
more than half.
Yeah, so more than half of the money that you pay for that bottle of whiskey goes to tax. So if you consider that if you get hold of an illegal shipment of exactly the same whiskey, you know, you can sell it for 50 rand and still be making a comfortable profit.
Huh.
So
you're encouraging criminal behavior.
Yeah, so that's always the consequences of sin taxes. But for some reason, we still insist on going down this path. And of course, we know what the illicit tax trade is costing us. I think Yusuf Abramji is making some money out of doing this whole take back the tax thing. which is kind of interesting because it's basically a campaign funded by one part of the tobacco industry to stamp out illicit cigarettes being put into the market by another part of the tobacco industry. It's all fun and games.
All right, so there's Mazzotti. Now, what is the cost of the SAA bailout? Because they say we need an additional 4 billion rand for the 2019-2020 year. The funding will come from a combination of government-guaranteed debt and recapitalization. According to the national budget...
Sorry, hang on a second. I thought the 4 billion was between now and June.
Oh, it may well be.
Yeah, and I recall it was a figure of about 27 billion for the year.
I heard that they've got that, but they need an additional 4 billion.
Okay, all right.
Over and above. So according to the national budget that was tabled by Tito Mboweni yesterday, the national carrier is still not generating enough cash to repay its maturing debt or cover working capital requirements. So they need to secure another 4 billion. This is terrible. They need a total of 21, as you said, 0.7 billion over the next 3 years for the implementation of the turnaround plan. So Tito's got his hands full with these parastatals.
Look, the interesting thing was the comments that Tito made after the budget speech. By the way, there's one thing that I must really praise Tito for. This was a short budget speech. Mm. If you consider to the rambling mess that Malusi Gigaba gave us, you know, where he kind of droned on and on. Tito was very focused, to the point, and he finished in an hour. You know, so... But
small mercies.
Yes, but he spent more time afterwards, and that stuff was more instructive, where he was saying in his post-budget comments that he would really rather have spent the money on PRASA, which is absolutely correct, because simply fixing things like Metro Rail has an immediate benefit on the overall economy. But there is no value in SAA being kept afloat.
There are people in the ANC who are hugely against... First of all, the privatization and anything that doesn't mean bailing out these state-owned enterprises. So Tito's trying to be adult about this, but there are people who just don't hear of it.
Absolutely right. But you see, the interesting thing is that people are very blinkered around the idea of what it would take to make SAA profitable. So let me give you a very kind of specific example. We have people who say that we should look to Ethiopian Airlines as an example because... They are clearly able to run it's a state-owned, profitable, efficient airline, mm-hmm. and why can we not do the same thing? And people don't understand that in the airline business, the important thing is the ability for you to be able to move people to multiple destinations quite efficiently. Now, because of its geographic location, pretty much in the center of the world, which is where Ethiopia is, if you consider you have Ethiopia and you have the UAE, and all of those airlines, they're able to operate very efficiently as a hub and spoke. Mm-hmm. So you fly from Johannesburg to Addis.
Right.
And then you have connecting flights to anywhere in the world. And that allows them to be very efficient in terms of how they move people quickly. Now, we are sitting right at the southern tip of Africa. So all of our direct routes are very limited in terms of the places where we're able to go to. So we're forced to make use of partnerships like the Star Alliance, which aren't really that efficient, because effectively what it means is that we become a feeder for, let's say, Lufthansa. Mm. So, you know, we fly up to Frankfurt and people then hop on Lufthansa to get from there on an SAA codeshare to other parts of the world. The other thing that continually screws us is the carbon tax. Now, let me explain how that works. All flights into Europe, the EU, they hit you with a carbon tax that's based on the fact that you've been flying long haul. Mm. So the carbon tax from Johannesburg to, let's say, Frankfurt again, is massive. The carbon tax from Addis to Frankfurt is absolutely minuscule because of the short distance.
Right.
So the people that we are competing with in order to fly to, let's say, London, if you take Emirates as an example,
mm-hmm.
Emirates, the total tax that they end up paying to the EU in order to fly someone from Johannesburg to London is substantially less than what SAA has to pay in order to fly directly from Johannesburg to London. So we are never going to win.
You can't compete with them, and don't compare yourself with them.
Yes, because of geography.
But we've been mismanaging. Forget about that. That's the basic economics of it. But it's also been mismanaged into the ground. We've bought fuel at inflated prices and then tried to use it when it's a whole lot more expensive.
Yes.
We just don't have anyone who understands basic economics in SAA.
That's correct. But before you start with the basic economics, you have to start with...
Is it viable?
Yes, with is it viable? And really, the reason why we keep SAA right now is because it's an ego trip for the ANC.
So what would be the cost of just letting it die?
Well, the cost would be whatever government guarantees have been put in place for the loans. But yeah, I say let it die.
Really?
Absolutely.
Let private enterprise come in and launch new airlines as they've tried and sometimes succeeded and sometimes failed.
Well, the reason why the private airlines have gone out of business, if you think about it, was because of anti-competitive behavior by SAA.
In fact, Comair just won a case to that.
Exactly. So, and you know, shout out to the guys at Comair because they lasted the distance in spite of the fact that SAA tried to squeeze them out of the market. But if you look in terms of Nationwide was squeezed out by anti-competitive behavior. They were actually profitable.
Huh.
Yes, but SAA basically forced them out of the market. We had one time, I don't know if you remember,
one time.
A very efficient airline squeezed out of the market by anti-competitive behavior by SAA.
And of course, the brilliant Santaco Airways. All right. The PSC, the Public Service Administration, the Public Service Commission, has said that they have decided Faith Mutambi is guilty of hiring staff at her private office. Faith Mutambi, we thought we were done with her, but there's still detritus in the system because of her. They found that Mutambi broke some rules when she appointed 27 people, including friends and relatives, to her department when she was public services minister. The limit allowed is 10. She put 27 in, and it's now been sent to the president. In a statement on Tuesday, the DA's Desiree van der Walt said, while findings were welcomed, she found it peculiar that the contents of the report were shared only with the president and the minister and not with everybody else.
Oh, the DA must just really stop whining about this. It got made public, didn't it? So what are they going to do? Issue another press statement? Look, I put this down as fake news at first because the idea that Faith Mutambi actually had friends seemed to be a bit incongruous. But moving on from that, I mean, really, I think that if one drills down into the current ministerial structures, I'm sure that we'll find more malfeasance of that nature. So, right. I mean, really, you know,
Small fry.
Yeah, it's small fry. I mean, we're talking about salary bills for 17 people compared to R1 billion a day that we are paying in outflows. I don't know.
Well, that ESCOM cost is what I think you're referring to. And Minister Mboweni said that it's not going to be on the government balance sheet, but it's still there. It's not as if it's going away.
Yes, because the increase in the debt contingency is in order to cater for the possibility that you'd need to provide money to them. Yes.
All right, Canton, we haven't brought this up with you before, and people have been asking on Twitter and everywhere else, what is your point of view on e-tolls? So, there's been a lot of discussion around this because the Gauteng ANC are talking with government about scrapping e-tolls. Government have been very sort of strict and stringent and strident about the fact that they're not going to change this. They're going to go ahead with e-toll. E-tolls must be implemented. E-tolls must be paid. But the Gauteng provincial government says, no, that's a very bad idea. And ahead of elections, it's going to cost them. So what's your point of view on this?
Well, there's a couple of point of views that one needs to take into account. Firstly, the reason why the Gauteng provincial government is saying that is because it's electioneering, because they know that it's unpopular.
Uh-huh.
I'm a fan of e-tolls.
Oh, see, this is why people wanted to know, because you're so contrarian.
Yes. Now let me tell
you're a fan of e-tolls.
Let me tell you why I'm a fan of e-tolls. And we have to actually differentiate between a couple of things. Okay, we have to take the idea that there was corruption involved in setting up e-tolls, and that needs to be ring-fenced as something that needs to be dealt with at a criminal level.
Mm-hmm.
But at the level of how we are meant to be running the economy of Gauteng, let me tell you why e-tolls are actually crucial.
Okay.
God isn't making any more roads. Can we just put this in perspective? All right. So now, in order for Africa's biggest economy, if you consider just Gauteng itself has a bigger GDP than most African countries.
Okay.
All right. Now, in order to keep this province running, you need the ability for business to be able to move effectively from one part of the province to another. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to do that, you need to have certainty. Certainty comes from the fact that if you get into your vehicle, you need to be able to know that you will get to the other end of the service chain in a specific time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you cannot do that if the roads are clogged with traffic. So how do you manage the process of ensuring that you can factor that in as a cost? So you need to have a system where the roads become more expensive at certain times of day, so that business can then factor that in into their cost. However, the overall benefit to the economy that comes from certainty means that business is going to be able to deliver more efficiently because they factor that in as a cost.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, what we need to do is to implement e-tolls very stringently, make the roads very expensive to use during peak hours, so that we are forcing behavior modification on the part of all of us. So those of us who can't afford to use the roads during peak hours will then shift our behavior so that our travel times then go outside of peak hours so that we're not clogging the roads. So e-tolls have been implemented poorly. You need a situation where, let's say, between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m., you don't pay any e-tolls by making use of the road. And the gantries are already in a position to do that type of thing. And then you have staggered periods. And then when you get to what is currently our rush hour, it should be very expensive for people to make use of those roads. And I know this is hugely unpopular because people would say, no, I've got to get my kids to school and all of that. No, actually, what is far more unpopular is the fact that the economy of this province is not able to make as money as efficiently as it wants to because you are not willing to pay for the privilege of making use of the roads at the same time.
Hmm.
So that's the overall philosophical framework around e-tolls. And that's why, we need to go down that route.
This dovetails quite nicely into two stories that came up in the news this morning. The first one around Deep Slurt protesting about power cuts when they're not paying for power, and around University of KZN students who are throwing mattresses out of windows on fire because they don't like the quality of the mattresses, which they're also not paying for. So basically, South Africans have to learn, all of us, rich and poor, we all have to learn that if you get something for nothing, that doesn't mean someone isn't paying for it.
Exactly. And the consequences of our not following through on e-tolls is that the economy right now, I mean, if you consider that you're a salesperson and you have to make, in order to break even, let's say you have to make 10 sales calls a day, just as an example.
Right.
Okay, so you make 10 sales calls and maybe you'll end up getting two of those come through and you keep your business ticking over. Currently, if you're not able to make those 10 sales calls because of traffic, that means that your business shuts down.
Right.
On the other hand, if you were able to make those 10 sales calls, but you paid a premium of, let's say, a couple of thousand rand a month, as an example, in terms of your e-tolls bill, as a result of that premium, but you make up that couple of thousand rand in one of those successful sales calls. So it makes a lot of sense. So this is a hugely unpopular view, but again, people actually don't take that big picture approach. Now, do I believe that there needs to be an investigation into the corruption in terms of how the e-tolls deal was set up? Yes. Do I believe that people need to go to jail for that? Yes. But e-tolls as a concept, we can't be putting up toll gantries on our freeway where you have to wait for the booms to lift, you know, as is the case in, let's say, the New Jersey Turnpike. It doesn't make any sense.
That's a terrible idea.
Yes.
We still have those in some places.
Yes.
On you know, the more outlying areas.
Yes. And if you consider, for example, if you work
out... Well, we've spent all this money building them. They're there.
Yes. But behavior modification is the thing that we need to be looking at. Right. If you work out the cost per kilometer, by the way, and I did this exercise, if we currently drive down to Durban, roughly the cost per kilometer that we end up paying on the drive down to Durban is roughly the same as what we end up paying on e-tolls. So we're very happy to pay it when we're driving to Durban. But, you know, because we're in the position...
Daily, monthly, what are you talking about?
Well, if you on a single trip down to Durban,
yeah.
If you work out the cost per kilometer of all of the toll gantries between Durban and Johannesburg...
It's about equivalent to the cost per kilometer.
The cost per kilometer that you would pay on making use of e-tolls, yes.
Okay.
But, of course, in terms of e-tolls, it's currently capped on a single vehicle for... I think you end up paying about 300 rand a month. Now, guys, you're paying... 800 Rand for DSTV, you're paying 900 Rand for 2020 uncapped fiber, and you don't want to pay 347 Rand for e-tolls? Now, come on. Get real.
All right. You've got me thinking differently to the way I was thinking before. But there is also something that's been proven with this e-tolls protest, effectively, is that people can stand up to government forcing them to pay more for things that they don't want to pay for.
Yes, but we can only do that in cases where we actually have control. So on our personal income tax, for example, we don't have control.
All right. Very good. Let's turn our attention overseas quickly, because we never get time to do this. You mentioned to me the other day that I should listen to Donald Trump's budget speech, which I then did as my homework. And I did find it very interesting. I found it interesting that it was a list of things that his government had achieved over the year rather than a list of things that they were going to promise to do. And I also thought it was interesting that he went on about unemployment going down. He talked about jabs being created, lots of jabs here, left and right and center. But I think the most interesting part of it was that he stood up for deregulation. He stood up for, and it was a small part of the speech, but he said, we're making business easier to do, both in America, where they obviously have reduced the amount of regulation and government interference, but also externally. He stood up to China and has turned around what was essentially China benefiting from America's inability to do certain work. I suppose that's something we've got to figure out, where in the world we belong in South Africa, in terms of skills, in terms of things like the textile industry, where we've learned some very hard lessons about other people doing things cheaper and more effectively than
in the case of textiles, we didn't learn the lesson, because we put in place those regulations around what minimum wage levels were meant to be. And the net result of that was that we shut down textile factories in places like Moy River, in places like Newcastle, simply because of the fact that they couldn't afford to compete at those levels. But of course, those are areas where the entire economies of those regions were dependent on the fact that those people were able to go into those textile factories and actually earn a living. Yeah. And now all of them have ended up on welfare. So, but we haven't actually reversed any of that legislation in terms of the labor legislation that put those factories out of business in the first place. There was a single road in Durban, Umbilo Road, that up until the time of the passing of the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, used to employ, just on that single road, there were 60,000 workers in the textile industry. Now, all of those factories have shut down, and there's 400 people who are still employed in a single factory that does boutique manufacturing. And so
it's ridiculous.
Yes. So
in a country where we keep talking about creating jobs.
Anyone who keeps talking about the fact that we need minimum wages, they're being utterly absurd, because minimum wages do destroy jobs.
But their argument is always that those workers are being exploited.
Well, no, but, you know, frankly, I would rather be earning a living than not, even if it's earning a living at a level that is... Here's something that people don't take into account. If you have a family of five, and let's say that three of that family are of working age, it is better for the economy to have those three people earning 5,000 Rand apiece than to have one person earning 15,000 Rand. It is better for social cohesion, firstly, because it means then that the two people who are not earning are not dependent on the whims and fancies of the one person who is earning.
Right.
Which, I mean, if you think about things
gives
like...
Gives them financial independence of some kind.
Yes, but I mean, you think about things like domestic violence, for example, and look at how often it gets tied to the idea that you have a single breadwinner who the entire family is economically dependent on, and who is then in a position to actually exploit the other members of the household. Because if that person gets sent to jail, then who is going to support the rest of the family? So there are all of these unintended consequences that come from insisting that people be paid this whole idea of a living wage. Now, a living wage is an absurd concept. Wages have to be taken into account on the basis of how many people can you get into employment at any given time? And the aggregate of all of the family members pooling their money together is ultimately what's going to create prosperity.
Yeah, and also it gives people a purpose.
Yes.
Wake up in the morning. If two of you are not working because one of the people in the family is bringing in 15 rather than each of you bringing in five, the three of you, and those two stay at home all day and they don't do anything, that's demoralizing.
You know, at the time of the 2002 World Cup, when I was still with ETV, and we were not making money at that stage. And,
yeah.
And at that time, my boss, Marcel Golding, he brought in his 14-year-old nephew to help us. You know, we were literally lugging boxes and equipment to create a World Cup studio at the time in at the ETV offices in Cape Town. And Marcel brought his 14-year-old nephew in to help us. And someone asked Marcel, you know, why have you got your nephew here, you know, helping us carry stuff around? And Marcel says he needs to appreciate the dignity of labor.
Mm-hmm. Very, very important.
Yeah. And Marcel, of course, now is a billionaire. But yes, it's an important life lesson, you know, the dignity of labor.
We should occasionally listen to billionaires, even if we don't like them very much.
Yes.
I mean, we were looking this week at what Bill Gates spends his money on. But effectively, when someone like that who has made a product that everyone in the world wants to use, we should listen to them far more than we do to political philosophers and theorists.
Yes. Bill Gates, by the way,
he's just also the world's biggest philanthropist, just by the way.
I must tell you, you know, Marcel doesn't talk about it. He's a huge philanthropist. He set up a personal foundation where most of his salary during the time that he was with ETV went towards it. And he refused to talk about it. I, you know, kept telling him we need to do some PR spin about it. And,
but he was also very, he was ousted.
Yes, he was, yes.
And it was very ugly.
It was very ugly.
He was basically forced out of the company that he'd created.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. Yes. But that's the nature of business. I mean,
what's he up to at the moment?
He's doing lots of interesting stuff.
Let's get him in here and talk to him at some point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Look, I have a chat with him every so often, and he's doing some fascinating stuff, particularly in terms of new technology.
A lot of those sort of people who've done very well don't want to talk about themselves, but we could tell him he can come in and we could talk about the state of the media business or any of that stuff just to get him in here. All right, any other things that you wanted me to take note of from the Trump speech? Because I did do it on your recommendation.
Yeah, I think the crucial thing, if one looks at the cesspit that is Facebook, which is different from the cesspit that is Twitter, most of my friends, and you know, these are people that I've known and loved for decades, hate Trump with a passion that I don't understand. Guys, we're South Africans. He is not our president, but you hate this guy so intensely. But if you
Jacob Zuma, who did actual damage to you, doesn't get as much hate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if you drill down into the stuff that Trump has managed to do very simply and very effectively, just by revisions to the tax code, for example, there's this concept called the earned income tax credit, which is a scenario where if you have a family with a certain number of dependents and you tick a whole range of boxes, you actually get more back from the taxman than you actually pay in tax at the end of the year. So you actually get topped up. So in other words, the government ends up paying you money because of the fact that you're working.
Right. Now, what do you make of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who are saying that we should take taxes up to 70% in some places?
She doesn't understand maths. And look, her heart is in the right place, but you know she doesn't understand maths. Someone did that calculation that if you took all of the billionaires in the U.S. and you took all of their money, all of it, every single cent of it, you'd be able to run the U.S. government for 6 months.
And that's it?
That's it.
So that's not sustainable either.
It's not sustainable.
Plus, of course, if you do that to very, very rich people, they just go elsewhere.
Yes, and in fact, one of the things that Trump actually did was
Then you'll have to build a wall to keep them in.
Yes.
Get about a wall to keep the Mexicans out.
But one of the things that Trump did was he told people like Apple, you know, Apple was sitting with the bulk of their capital in places like Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump said, look, guys, I'm actually going to change the tax code so you can bring that money back here so that it's not going to be penalized. And then you can use it to actually be creating jobs out here. So he incentivized people to bring their money back into the country. And guess what? Again, that feeds into the bottom line of the country.
So why do people hate him so much when they aren't even Americans and they aren't affected by any of his policies?
I'm fascinated by that particular effect, and you know, all I can say is that there is this tendency to just buy into the fact that particular people hate him, and those people are influential, and so everyone climbs onto that bandwagon. Look, he's.
I
wouldn't trust Trump around my daughters. Let's be very clear.
Yeah, and I don't think he's a nice person in terms of someone who you want to sit around and have a beer with. First of all, he doesn't drink, which I always find suspicious. And maybe he understands that the syntaxes that have just been imposed here, and it's a clever way of saving some money. But I don't think he's a nice person. I think that you can draw a distinction between someone who is fun to be around. And I remember when they had the election with George W. Bush and Al Gore. And it turned out that most women and men said they'd rather have a beer with George W. than with Al Gore. That doesn't mean anything to me.
No.
I don't think that matters. I'm sure Jacob Zuma is far more interesting to talk to than Thabo Mbeki. Jacob Zuma is more congenial. He's much more fun. He's more charming. He's more humorous.
And he dances.
Whereas Thabo Mbeki is studious and intellectual and serious and probably not very much fun at a dinner party.
I've had long chats with Thabo Mbeki at his home in Kilani, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
But not as entertaining as
not as entertaining. But
so what? Do you see the point, though?
Yes.
Thabo Mbeki should be in charge of things, not Jacob Zuma. And similarly, if Donald Trump is a horrible person, that doesn't necessarily mean he's a horrible president.
Yes. I think we probably should have an inverse correlation between a person's ability to dance and their ability to be a good president.
All right, that's about all we got time for this morning. The Burning Platform with Canthan Pillay. It's brought to you by Nando's, and you can join us next week for more. If you have any suggestions of things that you'd like us to cover, like, for example, the e-toll question that came up this morning with Canthan, you can send us an email, gareth@cliffcentral.com, and I'll pass it on to him, and he can come back to us with some thoughts. I thought you might want to just hear this before we wrap it up. Here's Annika Larson of ENCA talking to Julius Malema after Tito Mboweni's budget speech, and maybe just one or two last comments from Canthan on this. Here's Julius giving his opinion on the budget. Take a listen.
Devin, I do have the leader of the EFF, Julius Malema, with me. Thank you very much, Mr. Malema. It was seen by some as a pro-market budget, a trapeze act, if you like. Did it work for you? The opposition benches seemed happier than the ANC benches did.
Not at all. We think that it was flat. He's got nothing to offer. And he just repeated exactly what he said in the past. No clear plans on job creation, no clear plans on what's going to happen to the land expropriation, because we are busy expropriating the land. He did not reduce the VAT to 14%, and he did not introduce sovereign fund. And it's very clear that the minister doesn't know how to take South Africa out of this difficult challenges.
Do you think he managed what he said about SOEs? He said, do we really need SOEs? Do you think that came as a surprise?
That is an absolute nonsensical question. It doesn't even arise. We need the state-owned enterprises. His attempt from time to time to want to sell an idea that we can sell the state-owned enterprises, we'll never agree to that. We need those assets. Those are strategic assets. Some of them, their purpose of existence is not to make profit. It's to ensure that our people benefit from those state-owned enterprises.
Where do you begin?
Well, let's just get something very clear, that Tito Mboweni is a capitalist, and he was trained by Goldman Sachs. Whereas Julius Malema gets his money from a
illicit tobacco trade.
We give a disproportionate amount of attention to what Julius Malema actually says in terms of the economy. The EFF doesn't have the ability to influence any of this stuff right now. And, you know, frankly, the reason why we've gotten to this stage is because of the fact that we followed the policies that Julius has espoused. You know, he is the person who put Jacob Zuma in power, and those were the policies that were implemented that got us into this mess. I think that in terms of the land expropriation, you know, thank goodness that Tito actually kept his mouth shut about that, because the last thing that the ratings agencies want to hear at this point
is land expropriation. If there's a single thing that would have tipped us immediately to junk status, I think it would be that. I do think that it's inevitable, though, that we're going to head down the path of junk status. But I think the longer that we can hold out, the less we have to pay.
Hmm. And his thoughts about strategic assets in the state-owned enterprises and how they are there for the beneficiation of the people rather than to make a profit?
Yes. Again, he doesn't really understand how these things work in other parts of the world. And one really has to take a view, particularly in terms of power generation. Where does it work efficiently where you have a scenario where the power generation and distribution capacity is vested in the hands of a state-owned company without the need to constantly inject money into it?
You consider, are there any examples?
There's none that actually come to mind for me, because certainly the breaking up of Eskom into those various units actually makes sense, because the distribution grid, as an example, it would make sense for lots of power providers to be able to hop onto a existing distribution grid in much the same way as you have multiple ISPs who currently hop onto a single fiber line. Well, it's no longer telecoms.
Yeah.
So now it's people like Vumatel and right. And OpenServe
Just one last thing that he brings up, and this comes up often from people who have no other ideas. The thing he accused Tito of, the sovereign fund.
A sovereign fund is a great idea, but you need money in order to create a sovereign fund. You see, if the country was generating a profit,
yeah,
then we could do that. Now, back during the Mbeki era, in fact, what should have happened is instead of the money going into social grants, the money should, in fact, have been paid into a sovereign fund. And you build up the sovereign fund and then use the profits from that to pay out social grants. And that's how you actually end up growing the nation. But you can't grow a sovereign fund without money. Can we understand this? Before you can start saving, you need to be out of debt.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Canthan. That's plenty to chew on for the next couple of days, and we'll see you again next Thursday for more. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. It is 8 o'clock. CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.